KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, don't you understand? I'm a paleo nerd.
Hey, Ray!
David, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, and I'm really excited because I just love talking paleo, and this is Paleo Nerds, and we are the biggest nerds.
Yeah, some of us are nerdier than others, but I think we kind of balance each other out, man. I think we're total paleo nerds.
When I was a kid, if you were a nerd, it wasn't a good thing, but I'm proud to be a paleo nerd, so I'd be proud to be more nerdier than you in paleo.
Yeah, man. Well, nerd is the word, and I've been a lifelong nerd. I got to say that. I get into a topic. Is that the definition of a nerd? You just go way deep and...
Yeah, I think so, but, you know, wasn't there a movie where these kids are socially awkward as well?
Yeah, well, there's that.
so yeah, that's maybe the downside of it. But it's springtime here in Ojai.
As well as here in Ketchikan, Alaska.
And what determines, what's the first sign of spring after your horizontal rain and gray skies?
Well, there's deer now in the yards, and there's deer poop all over the yard. But they've been around all winter, but the robins and the thrushes are here in numbers.
Right.
And the crows and ravens are starting to leave town.
Oh, what? What? They stay for the winter and then split in the spring?
Yeah, they stick around town for the winter because easy meals and, like, you know, these humans are doing stuff. And then as springtime comes around, they start thinking of other things, you know, falling in love. But all kinds of little food sources show up elsewhere, i.e. like little grubs and little robin eggs to eat. And they just kind of go elsewhere.
Sure. And do the ravens and crows, do they eat any of the... the fish, you know, the seafood, the herring eggs that appear, and the
they are opportunists at every turn, but they do like to eat. Ravens like to eat baby birds.
Yeah,
and eggs.
That's right. I remember that from our Raven episode.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Protein wherever you can get it, just like me, man. I'm always thinking about the next cheeseburger wherever I can get it.
Yeah,
but yeah, man, and you're going on tour. You've been on tour.
I was in New Zealand. Well, it's like a mini Alaska. They have volcanoes and fjords and orcas. It's absolutely beautiful there.
It's on my bucket list. Someday I want to go. Pivoting to paleo stuff, you know, there's all this news that's been going on. You heard the latest about Tully Monster, right?
Right, right. Tully Monster is this weird long-necked thing that's about 30 centimeters long that they find in Mason Creek, Illinois. Fossil Lagerstätten, right?
That's right, right.
Preserved, soft bodied.
It's got the mouth in the end of a nozzle, eyes out on stalks, totally weird.
Yeah.
And we had a guest on who said it is a vertebrate. And
Yasmina.
Yasmina, she says chemical signature is there for vertebrate. She's proved it. And then out comes another paper. So saying, no, it's not a vertebrate. Can't be a vertebrate.
But I think that's what's great about science. It is until you're proven wrong, and then until they're proven wrong, and then it's back to what it isn't.
Well, I think I kind of still lean with Yasmina because, you know, they don't have any actual bone or anything. These are skin impressions. There's a lot of them.
Yeah.
The latest paper is all about the head muscles or whatever, you know. Right. So anyways, science is fun.
What do you think?
I'm going to stick with weird vertebrate. Or protovertebrate.
The reason why is this chemical signature that Yasmina Veeman, she finds it on a molecular level, on an atomic level.
Yeah. It fell out on the vertebrate side of all that, the chemistry. So I don't know. I trust what she was talking about. It was way beyond me, but I don't know. But I think there's so much about the, especially deep, deep time, the farther back you go, the less we know.
Yeah.
And
that rhymes.
Yeah, I guess it does.
So we have a fun interview today, and we have both been to this museum in Casper, Wyoming. Yeah, so it's a foursome today.
Yeah.
Like a game of golf.
Yeah, there is no I in foursome either, right? I don't know. But we will talk to both of them and see how it goes. And we'll try not to talk over each other.
You grab a 9-iron, I'll grab my wedge, and we'll pick up the phone and give them a ring to Casper, Wyoming, where they're both sitting in their offices right now awaiting Paleo Nerds.
The phone call.
Hey, Dave, meet J.P. Cavagelli and Russell Hawley from the Tate Geological Museum at Casper College in Casper, Wyoming. J.P. is the Field Operations Specialist, Collections Manager, and Prep Lab Manager for the museum, and Russell is an Education Specialist and a Fellow Visual Artist, as well as the type specimen for Paleo Nerddom. Hey, Russell. Hey, J.P.
Hey, guys.
Hi. Hi, Ray.
Hello. How's it going?
Russell, I want to start with you. And we do have four of us here on the old on the podcast today. But Russell, I actually figured out the exact day that I met you, sir.
No kidding!
Wow,
that's right. It was August 25th of 2000, and I was with a guy by the name of Kirk Johnson. You may have heard of him.
What's the paper you're holding up there? Some sort of a Venn diagram? What is that?
Well, this is my memoirs from that day, all those years ago, and all the things I did. And you may notice, Russell, that right beside your name here, actually, is I meet Russ, go to Tate Museum, Archaeotherium, and I've drawn a little hell pig.
Wow. Wow.
We decided that you were the type specimen for Paleo Nerddom because when I walked in, you and I were just drawn to each other, and we immediately started talking like, forget the dinosaurs, hell pigs are where it's at. So
my question to both of you, of the two of you, JP and Russell, which one of you is the bigger paleo nerd?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I will default to Russell by more than a metric yard.
Okay.
So Russell, why might you be considered the paleo nerd type specimen, sir?
Boy, I don't know. I think it's partly because field work has a certain amount of glamour associated with it. So if you're out there, you know, like Indiana Jones with your sun hat and your rock hammer, there's a certain romance about it. Whereas meanwhile, the guy who's crouching over his work table with his .005 micron technical pens.
Ooh, those tiny pens.
Maybe as more of a nerd.
Russell, were you born a paleo nerd? What's your origin story? Where were you born, and when did you come to love all things prehistoric?
Well, I was born in Seattle, Washington, or greater Ketchikan.
Lower Ketchikan.
Right. Yeah. Same flora, many similarities in culture. And but it took me 4 years to become a paleo nerd. And that was when my parents got me some plastic dinosaurs for Christmas, put in my stocking. And they just captivated me. I was obsessed with dinosaurs from that moment on. Mom and Dad said, oh, boy. It's the dinosaur phase. All the little boys go through the dinosaur phase. We'll just wait a bit, and he'll outgrow it. Here we are 50 years later. They're still waiting.
It's a terminal case.
Absolutely.
And JP, what's your background? Where did you begin?
Well, I began in Massachusetts in the summertime of, or let's just say the early 60s.
Yeah, man.
And I became a paleo nerd in second grade. Me and my friend Dave Vafiatis were dinosaur buddies. And by third grade, that was over.
Right.
And then I came back to it as a college student. And dinosaurs were way off the horizon. I was intrigued by fossil mammals, and I still find them more exciting.
Oh.
Although a good dinosaur fossil is pretty cool, too.
Yeah. You had an early dinosaur thing, but then you left it behind. And
like 4-year-old Russell did not do. Right. I did that. And
well, was this about failing calculus 20 times?
That would
No. Only three times. Yeah. Fail me thrice. Shame on me. Fail me 20. Oh, I forget how that goes. But at any rate, yeah. Mathematics are not my fuckton. I do not do well. Fuckton, it's a fifth word. It means area of expertise. Oh, okay.
Wait, can you spell that? Fuckton?
Yeah, T-H-U-K-T-U-N.
Oh, thank goodness. This is a family show. So, yeah. Russell, you're a fellow art major, though, too. So you went into fine arts because you can draw. Like, that was your childhood superpower, right? You could draw. And you went on to art school. Where'd you go to art school, and how did you end up at the Tate Museum?
Well, I went to art school at University of Colorado. Before I switched majors to fine art, I'd taken a bunch of science classes in preparation for becoming a paleontologist. Oh. So took comparative chordate anatomy, animal behavior, insect biology, just a lot of fun classes, interesting classes, dissected a salamander and a shark and all sorts of cool stuff. I don't regard those classes as a waste of time, because although I did switch to a fine art major, I ended up having to communicate with scientists in order to draw what they want me to draw and understand what they want me to draw. So if, you know, one of them says, now don't forget that the fossa antorbitalis is displaced anteriorly, I don't have to ask for a translation. I've got enough background to kind of
see. Can you translate that, please?
We don't.
It means the hole in front of the eye is set far forward.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all it means. But yeah, scientists love their jargon. And then I found out that for a modest fee, you could, well, it wasn't modest by my income standards at the time, but for a modest fee, you could join a real dinosaur dig. And so I got onto a couple of those, and that's where I met Dr. Robert Bakker. Oh. And spent several summers digging up dinosaur bones out at Como Bluff, the famous Como Bluff historical locality near Medicine Bow. Pretty soon they realized I was a lot better at drawing the bones than digging them up. So I spent more time during those last few years drawing the quarry maps that showed where all the bones were relative to each other.
Well, you are a fine illustrator, and we'll have examples of your work on your pages at paleonerds.com. So, JP, how did you come to be at the Tate?
Indeed.
What was your introduction there?
So I went to school in Chicago at some point, University of Chicago, and I took a little break from academia to come to South Dakota to go do research on prairie dogs with a fellow from Princeton named John Hoagland, who has now written the official book on black-tailed prairie dogs. And I was one of his many field assistants, and we spent February through June in a tower in Wind Cave National Park, watching prairie dogs from sunrise to sunset. Wow. So we were in our little sleeping bags, taking notes and stuff. And then near the end of the shift, one of the grad students said, hey, we're not working every day now. Let's go find some fossils. And we went out to the Badlands, not the national park, but we went out to what was then and still is. Private land. Well, this was before the feds outside of the National Park Service had any regulations. We went to what still is the National Grasslands, and I found an Oreodont skull, and I've been hooked ever since.
Wow.
So I went back to college, finished up, and I ended up getting a summer job with the University of Wyoming, collecting little Cretaceous mammal teeth for the summer here in Wyoming, and I kind of fell in love with little Cretaceous mammal teeth and Wyoming. And the funny thing is, collecting those little things, we didn't see a single one all summer long. We just collected bags of dirt at sites where they had been found in the past. And that's how I got into it.
Did you sift those bags later?
Eventually we did, yes.
And you found many teeth, obviously.
We found lots of teeth. And I took a little break to do some whitewater rafting and ski bumming in between.
Ski bumming, yeah.
Yeah.
I love that prairie dogs brought you out, and then you found an Oreodont skull. Yeah.
For those of you who don't remember, an Oreodont is kind of like a sheep-like. They were prolific, sheep-like. Are they from the Miocene or the Eocene?
They started in the late Eocene and went up to, I believe, the Pliocene. Paleo nerd Russell has to confirm my facts.
You are correct, sir.
In certain beds, they are the most common fossil you'll find.
Right.
And they are little herbivorous things about the size of a sheep.
And the American West was covered with them, and now they are no more. But
you couldn't walk around without tripping over them, and now you can't walk around in certain places without tripping over their bones.
So, Russell, you are like the artist in residence there, and you have been the artist in residence there for over 23 years, and you are also an interpreter as well. I was just wondering, with the both of you, too, I mean, I'll just start with you, Russ. What's the typical day at the Tate Museum for you, Russ? What do you, is there a typical day?
No, there's a lot of variety, so it's difficult to generalize, but it depends on the time of year.
Starts with coffee, then a broom, unlock the doors.
Open my email. but yeah, during the summer, we have just a river of tourists flowing Wow. through the museum pretty much all day long. And so summer days, I spend largely on my feet answering a zillion questions. And boy, I get some doozies.
Are you like the docent walking around with a name tag?
Exactly so, yes.
All right. Russell, you should share yesterday's question with them.
Yeah,
yes. Oh, it's a classic.
Right. I was explaining that a trunk is actually a great big long nose and that it doesn't fossilize. And then one little girl raises her hand and says, did mammoths have any boogers? I told her, you know, I got to hand it to you. I've never heard that question before. That's a brand new one. And then I thought about it a moment and I said, you know what? Probably not much, because every time they get a drink, they suck water up into their nose, and then they drink by blowing their nose into their own mouth. That's how elephants do it. That's how mammoths did it. And boy, that's like getting an hourly novage.
I used to have a opening act, which was an elephant that did a little show in Reno. And when I was able to touch the tip, it was always moist. So there had to have been some sort of mucus, and that's where you get boogers from.
Well, now that is a good point. Yeah. But I think it's implied that a booger is going to be dried mucus that's been right. accumulated.
Well, you know what? You should find, are there any booger paleontologists that we can research?
I think you're talking to the expert right now. The only one that ever considered this.
Oh, I've done it. I found my niche.
Yeah. I had a question for you. You do say that that was a doozy. Just to rattle off a couple of the other just more spectacular, dumb questions. There are come on.
Yeah, I won't say dumb. I'll say with minimum right. background information. did dinosaurs wear any clothes? Was another one. The others aren't coming to me at this moment. There are, of course, an enormous number of questions that I get very tired of. Many is the time I've had to tell the students, okay, I will not answer any more questions that start with the words, who would win in a fight between?
Right.
I don't know, and I don't care, and neither should you.
I take that one and I look at modern animals. If you have the skeleton of a modern house cat and the skeleton of a Irish setter, why, you could look at those two skeletons and say, this Irish setter is going to kick that cat's butt. But you know what? That cat, you can't, it's hard to tell these things from skeletons.
That's a very good point.
Especially with dinosaurs, because we don't even know which one the cat is and which one the Irish setter is.
I think, wasn't there an artist who took extant skeletons and applied paleontological constraints to them, and they came out quite different than what the extant animals look like?
Yeah, that was in a book called All Yesterdays. And yeah, it's become kind of famous.
What is the most special one that we can describe verbally for our listeners?
Well, I'd say the one that's become most famous for having completely failed to nail it on the head is the hippopotamus. Because right. If you've ever seen a hippopotamus, not only does it not look like a hippopotamus, it doesn't look like anything native to this planet. It looks like something that should be hanging up on the alien predator's trophy room wall. And the artist just gave it no lips, no cheeks, just tusks sticking out of its mouth in various esoteric directions. And it looks weird, creepy, and you'd never in your life guess it's a hippopotamus.
Right. So wow. That begs the question, to what extent have we failed in fleshing out our dinosaurs?
Sometimes I try not to think about it.
Right.
Well, there was the recent paper with claiming that T-Rex, was it, had lips?
Oh, the lips.
Had
right.
lips.
Right.
That's been a debate for century, at least, I think.
We brought that up a couple episodes ago, and I'm just not going to go back and change all my art. You know, Photoshop can fix it all. But
and, you know, the jury's still out on that. There are still others who are steadfastly insisting, I'm not going to mention names, Tracy Ford, steadfastly insisting that dinosaurs had no lips.
Well, I've got a question. Now, a hadrosaur is not a predator, but there is a hadrosaur mummy or two. Is the skin pulled back so far you can't tell what their mouth parts looked like?
Well, hadrosaurs wouldn't have had lips. Nobody is suggesting that hadrosaurs had lips because there's a very
What I'm saying is we haven't yet found a mummified T-Rex, which is a possibility.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
I think from what I know that most of the hadrosaur skeletons don't have much, or mummies, I should say, don't have much mummification on the head. And if we do, it's distorted enough that you can't make a good reconstruction, or you can't make a non-controversial reconstruction.
Sure.
I know that the feet on the Berlin specimen are just, and I think the New York City specimen, are just beautiful with little pads and half-webbed toes or something like that. But I think the head stuff just got a little more distorted, and I've seen a few of them, and I can't remember the actual answer, but that's my gut feeling.
So the jury's out until we see a head impression of a T-Rex that fell in the mud.
The lipstick.
Or even a small cousin of it.
Yeah, yeah.
JP, at the museum, what are you doing during the day while Russell's out there leading people around?
Well, see what we're doing here, sitting at the computer. This is what I do a lot of. Right now, I'm spending my time. We do an annual conference here, the Tate Conference, which we've been for how many years, Russell? 27. Yes, 27 years.
The and Triassic Conference.
It's Triassic this year, so I've been organizing that, and that takes a lot of my time this week. And then a lot of cataloging. We do a lot of collecting in the summer, and I have a flock of 10 volunteers who actually work on the bones, and I answer their questions and give them advice, and they are piling up the bones faster than I can catalog them. So cataloging is a big part.
So you're warehousing your discoveries, and you've got, do you have a prep lab that people can watch?
We do. We've got a big fishbowl prep lab. Yeah, people can watch. Okay. They can help. Not only can they watch, but and I shouldn't publicize this, but I will. They will. They can knock on the window and say, "Hey, what are you working on?" And it's a sliding window, so we usually put someone sociable up in front of that window, and oftentimes they're out there talking to their families and groups of kids who really want to know what the heck they're doing, and it's pretty cool. It's a kind of a one-on-one museum experience for a lot of these folks.
What's in that lab right now?
Let's see. There's a big jacket in the middle with some what used to be articulated sauropod tail bones, and I've got three people working on that one. Unfortunately, the bones were right on the surface, so the quality of the bones is pretty, what's the word, crappy? But some of them are salvageable, and this dinosaur actually had a skull associated with it, so that part's pretty cool.
Cool.
More on that later. I mean, a lot later once we get it prepped. Like later in this program.
You're dropping hints everywhere here, JP. Jeez.
Got to keep people interested.
Well, actually, speaking of dropping all these hints, actually in emails we were exchanging, you said not to mention the marine crocodile. And then you said, maybe I could mention it, but he said, don't mention the marine crocodile is so cool.
Hey, if you said you can edit things out.
I sure can, but that's only if I choose to.
No, we can mention the marine crocodile.
Why is it cool?
How old is it? Where'd you find it?
Well, those are a couple of good questions. Actually, it's three good questions. How old, where we find it, and why is it so cool? Let's do
what Derek Briggs called X from the Y-ity of Z-land.
Wow.
You are a paleo nerd, Russell. Yeah.
And not only does he know this stuff, he remembers it. Yeah, so it's a marine crocodile from the Cretaceous. So crocodiles right now are mostly freshwater, you know, Australian saltwater crocodiles. By their name, will play in salt water, but they're just as happy in fresh water. But these things were primarily marine, living in oceans, and they are well known from certain parts of the world and not very well known from Montana and Wyoming. Mm. There's one good specimen in Montana, and there's, I think, one anyway, but there's none from Wyoming. So this is hopefully, right now we have three or four bones exposed, and that might be the best Cretaceous marine crocodile from Wyoming. We got a half exposed last year, and then it turned into just a huge rock with bones exposed. And so we're trying to collect this huge rock.
And why is it so cool?
Because it's a one of a kind.
Right.
And again, you know, I think dinosaurs are cool, but crocodiles are even cooler because we know what they look like, and we can just imagine them going back and tickling the feet of those dinosaurs, or in this case, the mosasaurs.
Since it's a marine crocodile, would it have had flippers instead of fingers?
I think it would have. I mean, I think certainly the toe bones would have been maybe more closely knit.
Yeah, but the webbing, unfortunately, doesn't preserve. Exactly. So, I mean, they're so well adapted. These crocodiles went into the ocean two or three different times independently during the course of their history. And one group got a lot farther along than the others, and they lost their armor, and they really do look like the toes and fingers were fully webbed into really, truly little flipper paddles.
The other thing to consider there is that modern crocodiles are primarily tail propelled. So would they even need webbed feet?
Interesting. Should we get into the controversy, Ray?
I could see you're mulling that over.
I am.
Broach the topic, sir. Well, let me set it up, and then
you set it up, and then I'll tell you where I get my evidence from.
You know, I love walking into the Tate. Every time I come there, I see the killer pig up there. I see D the mammoth and say hello. He's lost half a tusk, you know. And this last time I came in, there's a, lo and behold, what? There's this big ceratopsian back here. It's a torosaurus. It's massive. It's huge. I hadn't seen it. And there's your setup.
Oh, and I'm saying, no, it's not a torosaurus. It's just a grandpa triceratops.
Ooh. Oh, Dave, oh, Dave, oh, Dave.
It's just an old triceratops. When you look at the morphology and you look at them from juvenile, nothing changes except the holes get bigger. I mean, the skull does change in shape a bit, but it's just an old grandpa triceratops.
And whose horns have fallen off, I guess.
Yeah, tell me why it's a separate species.
I'll take the first bat, and then Russell, you can do the fine tuning. How's that sound? I think a lot of that is based on the fact that Triceratops is very common in the Lance and Hell Creek formations of the late Cretaceous of the Western Interior Area. Torosaurus is not. So that's the start of the setup. There are, at this point, I think ours is the sixth fairly complete skull that's known. The largest one, it's got a skull that's 9 feet long.
Wow.
It's the largest skull of any land animal. I get my L words confused. So it's got the largest skull of any land animal. And wow. So it's big. It's fair assumption to say that that animal is very old. Now, is it an old Triceratops? The folks who did that study are certain to say so. But because they came out and did that study, people have started looking at ceratopsian remains a little bit more. And I have heard word, and I won't say from who, because honestly, I can't remember. But I've heard word that there have been smaller torosaurus-type skulls found out there, which would blow that whole theory out of the water.
Sure. Sure. And is there any type of an aging evidence, you know, growth rings on a triceratops or ceratopsian?
There should be, but I don't know if anybody has actually studied that just yet. I smell feces. Maybe somebody listening out there right now is.
If only, you know, aged ceratopsians have the giant holes in their frills and you can't find any young ones, then they would.
Well.
That might be a smoking gun, but
we've had some previous guests who've talked about the, you know, the histology, the bone, the marrow can really tell you the age of the animal too. But Russell, you wanted the back clean up there on the Torosaurus versus Triceratops.
That's a sports reference. He doesn't know those.
Not a clue.
Right, I'm with you there, dude. But
I think what is great about science is just that a paper comes out that proves Joe wrong, and then Fred does a paper that proves Joe right, and then Fred's wrong. And I mean, it's fantastic how science is ever changing.
Yeah,
it's a lot of the fun. I was just going to say that because the ranges of the two forms are different, that really, up in Alberta, Canada, people find Triceratops but no Torosaurus. Down in New Mexico and Utah, people find Torosaurus but no Triceratops. Here in Wyoming, we're lucky. That's where the ranges of the two forms overlap.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah. But so I do think it's a different species, but because it's so bloody similar that people are actually proposing that it's nothing but a senior citizen Triceratops, I would suggest a compromise and regard it as a separate species within the genus Triceratops. So we'd have the Triceratops viridis, and then another species within that genus, right. Triceratops latus.
Right. That makes sense to me, too, is that there's this variation within the genera, within the genus. Right. So, I mean, it's a Triceratops torosaurus, toro. But there we are. We're getting deep into science and stuff. But yes, JP, you've raised your fingers, sir.
I also want to say that since we've had our torosaurus skull mounted, her name is Nicole, by the
way.
Yeah,
I see Nicole.
Since Nicole's been mounted and on display, we've had two visiting scientists come over and measure her. And she was found about the same time they found one in a construction site in Denver. The one in Denver,
right. I know about that one.
Has a lot more postcranials. We just have a skull. The one in Denver is a pretty good specimen. And I think there's going to be papers coming out based on these two specimens that just might answer these questions. Again, I leave you with a teaser.
Okay.
And what does postcranial mean?
Postcranial means
from the neck down.
Yes, past the skull. So posterior is butt-wise, anterior is nose-wise, posterior to the skull. Postcranial.
So how does it happen when somebody runs into a torosaurus out in the field somehow? Did you guys find that, or did you get an emergency phone call? Come get this torosaurus. There's a bulldozer about to take this down. How did that one come to the museum?
Well, our geology professor actually has been doing field trips out to this one ranch near town, and he's the one who found it. His name is Kent Sundell. I think Ken Russell mentioned him earlier. Kent found it on one of his geology class field trips, and he said, hey, we should go collect this thing. And we thought it was a Triceratops, of course, for years and years. Well, it took one of our volunteers, I think, 3 years to prepare that thing. And somewhere in that year three, we realized, hey, wait a second, this frill is really, really thin, and it comes to a holy end.
Wow. And I've read too, JP, that you were out enjoying nature when you found the Tyrannosaurus.
I like to think I was enjoying my coffee, Ray. Nature is always out there to enjoy.
Expose yourself to the wild.
That's right.
Recycling it.
Letting the coffee go, as it were.
So tell that story. What's the story? Finding a T-Rex out in the wild.
Well, we've been doing these pay-to-dig trips for 18 years now, as long as I've been here at the Tate.
How much does an average person pay to do a dig?
An average person pays $4,000, but we let most of our people come on for about $1,100.
And for how long? Are they volunteers or just tourists?
That's 5 days. No tourists, volunteers. 5 days, you can either dig in the Lance Formation or the Morrison Formation, and we take you out Monday through Friday and put you in a hotel, feed you all the food you can eat.
Wow.
Beer is on your own, Dave.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're on one of these trips, and we were at one of these sites that we would take people to, because there's lots of little bones washing out of it. And I would tell them, go find some bones, scatter to the four winds, people, find some bones. And I discreetly went over to get rid of my coffee where nobody could see me.
Tossing the cup out.
And playing strategically with the wind so that nobody could tell later whether I had been... Yeah. Tossing the cup out.
You were having a whiz. Come on.
Oh, okay. Someone had to say it. And
I call it contributing to the World Nitrogen Fund.
And I walked over this little area that had some bones, just kind of between the blades of sagebrush. And we left them there for quite a while. Didn't realize what they were, but we left them there as a show and tell to what bigger bones look like.
Wow.
And then one day we decided to explore it. And we could tell at that point that there was a couple of vertebrae lined up. And on the edge of the rocks, we could see enough bones sticking out of the rock to say, oh, cool, this is a T-Rex.
Really?
And wow.
Then we made a deal with the landowners to collect it, and they were quite amenable. They were actually quite excited.
This is exposed to the air? These bones are out?
It was only one vertebra that was actually exposed to the air, and actually those pieces of eroded vertebra next to it.
How much did you have to reveal to definitively determine it's not an ornithomimid and it's a T-Rex?
Well, A, it's big. It's in a 18-foot-long rock. And sticking out of the tail end of the rock, if we can call it that, because there were two tail bones sticking out, which were not in the rock. So the rock is called a concretion, which is basically a hard rock that forms around usually something organic. So the concretion grew, but it didn't grow big enough to cover these last two tail vertebrae, and they were distinctively T-Rex.
Wow.
they have special shape to them. And we spent 5 weeks the next summer digging it up. Then we spent some time the next three summers looking for the head, and we got skunked. But we have a cool specimen.
So it might be out there, but...
Well, you know, that third year, we made a really big hole, Ray. We about 100 feet all over the place, and yeah, we looked for it. Nothing.
It could be in the Gulf of Mexico by now.
And why do you think? Why is a skull so... They're so huge and strong. I mean, so many specimens don't have skulls.
Well, this one is an articulated specimen, so it's 22 feet of vertebrae, most of the pelvis, and one femur, and all that is still in life position, pretty much. So it's not just the skull that washed away, it's the tip of the tail, it's most of the legs, it's the shoulders and arms, it's the neck, and the skull.
Was it a river basin?
We think it was a floodplain.
Right.
And the animal died, started decomposing. And then another flood came along and moved most of the animal downstream. But this massive piece that was the middle of the body probably still had enough gooey parts on it that it didn't move as far. The rest of the animal went floating down to the Cretaceous Gulf of Mexico. Well, at that point, it would have been the Cretaceous Sea that was only 50 miles away.
I'm interested. It's called the Lee Rex. And given its method of discovery, why is it called the P-Rex?
I have never thought of that. You know?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, anyway, here's my question. And I've always... So the Hell Creek Formation, 66 million years old. The Lance Formation, same age?
Same thing.
Same thing. So it's right there with the asteroid 66 million years ago. Why is it called the Lance and not the Hell Creek?
Hometown pride.
Hometown pride? Is that really how it is?
A Wyoming geologist was doing the geology of Wyoming at the same time as a Montana geologist or a Dakota geologist. I guess it would be Montana because he named it after Hell Creek in Montana. And the two met somewhere on the borderline and said, hey, wait, this is the same stuff. Yeah, but I'm not changing my name, damn it.
Right.
So really, the Lance Formation could continue outside the state, and but then it's a Hell Creek.
And it goes into Colorado, and it's called the Laramie Formation down there.
Okay, all right. Thank you. I just want to say, and that's one of the very, you know, when I worked on Cruising the Fossil Freeway with Kirk Johnson, he was at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science at the time, and we got this book contract, and he said, you know, the very first place that we have to go to trolls, we just got right the heck out of Colorado and went to Wyoming because, he said, it's got everything. And you go pretty much all the way through the geologic column, and you've got, you know, Cambrian stuff, but you've also got, you know, all the Morrison, you got the Cretaceous, all that good stuff.
All the good mammal beds above the dinosaurs.
And you have Fossil Cabin. You have Fossil Cabin.
Well, you have the cabin that walked, yes.
A building that's made out of huge chunkosaurus bones. It's absolutely
insane. That's out of the Como Bluff, but...
It is.
But the Eocene beds of Wyoming are world renowned, and I understand that you guys are starting to dig there too, JP. And what's so cool about the Eocene there?
Oh, it's so boring. There's no dinosaurs. Wide variety of mammals, and Russell will list all 172 genera right now.
No, I'm not going to list every Eocene mammal.
Just for our listeners, the Eocene starts 10 million years after the KPG boundary.
Yep.
And it goes to about 33 million years ago.
Yeah, it's long. Yeah, it's the longest epoch of the age of mammals. It's longer than the Margaret Thatcher administration.
It went on and on. But what is cool? Give us a flavor of what the Eocene has in Wyoming there.
Well, if I want to showcase something for Eocene weirdness, you can't beat you into Therium. I mean, a rhinoceros with six doorknobs on top of its head and saber teeth.
And it was huge.
Yeah, they were huge.
Oh, yeah. This is the first real mega mammal. This is the first mammal that got up to a weight of over a ton.
Really? So,
Yeah, rhino-sized as well as roughly rhino-shaped. And yeah, very scary-looking thing. When Cope found one, they say that all night long, after they dug it up during the day, all night long, Cope was having nightmares that this thing was chasing him and trampling him and tossing him in the air. Too much imagination for his own good.
So we'll have a picture of one of those, but why the knobs? What's that about?
Why the teeth?
Well, actually, the one that kind of explains the other.
They were herbivores.
Yeah, they were herbivores.
Yeah, and so the teeth are really weird because they're serrated. I mean, they're not. They are not only shaped like saber teeth, but they've got serrated edges. And so, what's up with that? I don't know. It's not widely advertised.
And Russell, as a visual artist who loves drawing cool stuff, you were drawn to those. You know, I was drawn to those.
Another.
And I remember, so to speak, we were drawn to it. Get it? I remember Johnson saying too. They are huge, but he said they've really got spectacularly big butts. Huge hips.
Almost everybody draws them from the side, so you rarely get a sense of just how broad that pelvis is. But yeah, it's ridiculous. They've got an abundance of junk in the trunk.
So why the knobs? And wait. So yeah, serrated teeth. Let me guess. Is the serrated teeth because they're eating really waxy or hard plant stuffs?
That's one suggestion, and then anti-predator weapons is another suggestion. Mm-hmm. But if two of these guys went after each other with their teeth, they'd slice each other to ribbons and probably die of massive infections a week later. But with the blunt knobs on top of their heads, they could have these non-lethal duels where they bruise each other and leave the combat black and blue, but at least not bleeding from a thousand wounds. So that's one idea, is that that's why the knobs, they're non-lethal dueling weapons.
For the males, and are the females different?
Boy, that's something I...
Yeah. Is there sexual dimorphism in these Uintatheriums?
I just remembered a diagram I saw that showed the difference between males and females. And yeah, the females are different. Their heads are smaller and their knobs are shorter. And I think their saber teeth are smaller too. Damn, where is that diagram? It's around here somewhere.
Sorry. You got one. But do you have one in the museum? Are you going to get one?
Not yet.
Ah.
We're working on it.
So I'm still confused. What is the earliest evidence of any animal developing any type of armor specifically for headbutting their opponent to win the girl?
Wow.
Mozcop. That would be the dinocephalian therapsids from the Great Karoo in South Africa.
Oh, right.
I was going to guess that too. Wait.
Yeah, me too.
Almost got you.
You're talking about the cynodonts way back?
No, that's the other branch. Yeah, so there's this small, very mammal-like carnivorous branch, the cynodonts, although some of them...
And they had huge tusks too.
Yeah, knobs.
And they were cute.
Yeah, they were cute.
They probably were. I better decide if they were cute or not. I've got to draw one coming up in the next month or so. But there was also, though, a big, weird, grotesque group of plant eaters, the dinocephalians. And they...
Little tails?
They got stubby little tails, yeah. And some of them had a kind of triangular body shape, the shoulders higher than the hips, a neck held up diagonally. And
they looked like mammalian bullfrogs, kind of.
A little bit, yeah, yeah.
With the armor.
And you reckon that armor was not for protection from predators, but mating dominance.
Yeah, bashing each other. Probably not going head-to-head.
Right.
Bighorn sheep can get away with that because they've got these very broad, flat horns that provide a very broad area that they can collide with. But yeah,
they don't need chiropractors for the discs in their
right.
Necks. Yeah.
Although, watching them in action, I'm amazed that they don't break their necks.
Russell, you said you had to draw one, draw a creature here in the next couple of weeks or something. Do you take direction? How do you get your assignments? I don't take direction well at all, but are you told what to draw? Who decides that?
Well, it's complicated. I sometimes do get instruction on what to draw, but I'm given a pretty free rein. I mean, nobody around here ever tells me, you know, oh, make the neck a little longer. Oh, make the eye a little bigger. Oh, I don't like that pattern of stripes or whatever. They pretty much turn me loose to do what I want to do. on my own. Now, I also do sometimes, very rarely, but sometimes I do commissions for professional paleontologists, and they will often have some very specific ideas about what they want.
Russell, have you created an illustration to later find out that it was anatomically incorrect?
More times than I'd care to admit. Yes, no, that has happened many, many times.
Well, it's the nature of science. You learn.
I'll butt in and say, oh, Russell often comes up to him and says, did you guys see this paper this past week? They say Tyrannosaurus Rex has lips. I got to draw all my dinosaurs all over again. He usually doesn't, and he just smiles.
Yeah, just smile. I just wanted to say that, Russell, I've enjoyed your art all these years, and you could get some of your art there at the Tate Museum, but it's wonderful to walk around the Tate and see all this. You know, it's almost a lifetime of work that you've got there, man. It's like almost 25 years you've been there, I guess, and there's so many illustrations.
But you have one of everything, which is great.
Yeah, but I want the great compendium of Hawley drawings. It must happen, sir, in a book.
That's a retirement project, right, Russell?
Right. One of many. JP and I are going to be so busy if we live long enough to retire. I was going to say that it's really nice to hear praise coming from Ray Troll. I've been an admirer of your artwork ever since I first saw it. The first picture I ever saw of yours, I think, was either Fish Worship, Is It Wrong? or Spawn Till You Die. I don't remember which of those two. I know they were fish-themed, and I thought to myself, oh, my goodness.
Well, thanks, Russell.
Yeah.
This guy shares my sense of humor.
I remember the first thing he said, you know, and when we're geeking out, it's like, it is not all about the dinosaurs. You know, people just, you know, they're just drawn to dinosaurs, and like, there are all these other cool creatures. And so you've been shining a light all these years. But we bonded over Hell Pigs all those years ago, man. So,
well, you know, there's never been a movie where, you know, Archaeotherium was the star. Because that would be, can you imagine a Hell Pig running through a city?
Oh, dude. I've written out the little fantasy scenes for the Hell Pig, the movie.
Yeah. No. Oh my God. Unleashed from Hell. These things were nasty.
Oh yeah. And actually there's evidence. You guys have the evidence, and Sundell worked in this, right? And you did the illustrations where the little tiny camels were ripped in two and then stashed away in little Hell Pig cage.
Yeah, right? In a meat cage. And the thing is that they wouldn't go for the front legs. They went for the juicy butt rump, the rump steaks.
Yeah, I want to watch that movie.
Yeah, well, see, this is why they need to stop churning out sequels to Jurassic Park, because David Drake's Time Safari and Rivers of Time, the Gun for Dinosaurs series by L. Sprague de Camp, both include lots of scenes set in the tertiary, not just the age of dinosaurs. And so if Hollywood could get rid of their Jurassic Park tunnel vision, they could make those.
I'll tell you why there's a tunnel vision is that the idea that monsters were so big that could kill and eat you really existed. People don't realize that the stuff of nightmares were in the Paleocene, the Eocene, the Oligocene. They existed in the Cenozoic. Oh, yeah, so, you know, Hollywood needs to get on the Cenozoic bandwagon.
There were some pretty big carnivores in the Eocene, too.
JP, what's the coolest fossil prep ever?
Oh, yeah, okay.
Oh, do you mean coolest thing I've worked on?
Yes.
I mean that you're working on, you're going, I can't believe I'm working on it.
I've done two that I are on top of my list, and I think Ray knows one of them quite well.
Oh, man.
So I'll hold that one for a second. But I did a little Cretaceous crocodile that was maybe the size of my head, curled up in a little ball from Tanzania, and eventually published as Pachycephalus.
Oh, wow.
And it was just so damn cute. And it was a crocodile with a skull was
fully articulated?
It was fully articulated, I would say 90%. It was full size, and it's a part of the family of Notosuchians, which is a Southern Hemisphere Cretaceous group that just did all kinds of weird things, including these guys were apparently vegetarians.
What?
They had teeth like mammals. They had mammal-like teeth.
Wow.
Vegetarian crocodile.
Yeah.
Wow.
Believe it or not.
Wow.
And they did not have pointy snouts. This guy had a little round button snout, if you will. And he was just so damn cute.
I want one. Oh. Yeah.
Me too.
And that number and two.
Number two, I'm going to let you pronounce it, Ray.
Gunnica Date.
Yeah, gunnukadate.
Excuse you. Let me get you a tissue. Gunnukadate.
Gunnukadate. It was a Triassic nothosaur from the great state of Alaska.
Thalatosaur, sir.
Thalatosaur. Yes, thank you. I'm glad someone's here to keep me straight.
Keep me straight, man.
Thalatosaurs are a little marine reptile from a group that is fairly not well known. The thing was maybe 2 feet long.
Wow.
Well, with the tail, it was longer. But yeah.
But the specimen was missing a bunch of the tail, but it got weathered away by the ocean. And it was found in southeastern Alaska within the intertidal zone. Yep. So it had things like barnacles growing on the rock. But I got invited to go work on it up in Fairbanks at the University of Alaska, and I spent 5 weeks up there.
With Pat Druckenmiller?
Yes, with Pat Druckenmiller.
And Jim Bastel was there when it was found. And Gunnukadate is a Tlingit sea monster. It was a story in Tlingit culture. And I had originally suggested that when I found out about this Latosaur, and it was found near
the town. You suggested the name, Ray?
Yes, I did.
Oh, really?
I knew about it.
That's how he knows about this thing.
Well, I knew about it, and Jim Bastel let me know about this Thalatosaur coming from the Triassic rocks. And we have the same Triassic rocks on Gravina Island here in Ketchikan. Oh. And so I was all excited. I've been tracking all this all these years. But when it was found, this remarkable marine reptile, just the preservation on it was extraordinary.
Yeah.
But it's right there near the town of Cake, which is a Tlingit village, and it just seemed like the appropriate thing to do. And I suggested it to Pat Druckenmiller and Jim, and then they liked the idea. And then I approached Rosita Wuerl at the Sea Alaska Heritage Foundation to see if it'd be appropriate, and if the elders, and it's actually an important crest animal for a number of the clans in Southeast. You don't just arbitrarily go about naming something things, without. Yeah. Without talking to somebody, just to see if it's appropriate, and if the elders were excited about it.
If you suggest the name, does that mean you name it?
No, I didn't do that. No.
So you suggest the name. The name becomes kind of the nickname, but not the taxonomic name.
It is the taxonomic name. I suggested it.
Right.
The scientist said that's a perfect name.
Right.
Then I said, let's get some approval on it. But it's a sea monster story that's been told up and down the coast. And this, even though it's diminutive, this is a little guy, it maybe is a juvenile.
Sure. But,
so there is, I've asked Druckenmiller about this.
Yeah.
But I just got to say, JP, too, and I want to throw some light on you here now. No shade, no, only light, because you the two of you are extraordinary. And JP, you're known around the world for your fossil prep skills, your preparation skills. And you were called
thanks,
in.
Man.
This is the only one in the world, the only fossil this animal ever found, and you don't want to screw that up. And the workmanship that you put into that, you got to know, how do you do that where you know exactly where to stop as you're, were you using an air scribe? Were you chiseling?
I was using basically a tabletop sandblaster under the microscope. We talked about Russell using a 0.005 micro pen to do stippling. And that kind of work is way too fast. So this is, it's just a question of going very slowly and patiently. I mean, 5 weeks to work on a specimen that's only 2 feet long.
Right.
That'd give folk an idea how much I was doing per day.
But every rib, every tiny tooth, everything was there. And it was exquisite. And it's
down to the toes.
It's a work of art. And it just makes you appreciate
it. But that's heavily metamorphic rock.
Oh, yeah.
That's.
It's not metamorphic, but it's very hard stuff,
and
it is flattened. It's a flat specimen. But the cool thing about it, it has this really pointy snout with no teeth in the first, I don't know, 3/4 inch.
Hmm.
And then it has this row of, two rows, I mean, top and bottom, of just nasty-looking teeth.
We'll have a picture of it on your page.
I think there's a painting by Mr. Ray Troll.
Yeah, then so I got to draw the image, and anyways, and we have a cast of it here at the Ketchikan Museum right now.
I have one here too.
And you've got one
there.
Thanks,
Pat.
It's a really cool thing, but I think it's probably time for the question, A.D. All right, gentlemen, and I will put this to both of you. What epic epoch, what perfect paleo period, what awesome age what time period would you want to go back to, and what would you want to see given that you were able to get to into a time machine and go back and look at something? Over to you,
Russell.
Oh boy, it is a tough call. It's a pretty close, almost three-way tie, but I'm still going to hold out for the Devonian.
Oh.
You know, if you go back to a Cretaceous forest, well, you can find forests a bit like that in Louisiana and Florida. If you go to a Jurassic forest, it's a little bit like the monkey puzzle forests in Chile. If you go back to visit a Devonian forest, you might as well be on another planet. There would not be a single recognizable plant to ferns. You except for horsetails. Yeah, ferns and horsetails. But the trees?
Massive trees
with leaves on their trunks instead of bark, and plants like gigantic stalks of asparagus, and it would just be such a weird alien environment. And of course, we often have to reconstruct these forests from bits and pieces. I want to see it green and growing.
Excellent. And I want to go fishing there too, of course, and you know why.
Cool.
JP,
I just want to say that I love to hear the paleontologist Russell, who's been talking about animals, and you ask him that question and he goes right to plants. That's pretty cool.
That's cool.
Unexpected.
My answer is, and I'll go back to the Eocene, because the Eocene has all these weird mammals, referencing the Green River Formation in Wyoming, which has the second richest bird fauna of the Eocene after some dump in Germany. But being a bird watcher all my life, I would love to go bird watching in the Eocene.
Wow.
I think that would be so cool.
And would you go to the Simpsons age, the Bartonian?
I think the Bartonian is in Europe. I don't even know where it fits in the... I would go to the Wasatchian or the Bridgerian here in North America.
I see that Dave's got a cue card there. He's reading.
I have all the ages. I have all the epochs.
You must have it on the wall there.
I have the ages. I have the periods and sub-periods. But my little card says, in the Eocene, there's the Eprisian.
Yep.
That's the first one. Then the Lutetian, Bartonian, and Priabonian.
Those are the European ages.
So those are European. So these ages are indicative of the world. They're indicative of where you are.
They're based on similarity of fossils. Generally, I'm going to say on a
reading
variable
a European
scale.
Cue card while you guys are in Wyoming.
But there are conversions, and the periods almost follow each other.
Yeah.
And if you go to New Zealand, they use totally New Zealand terms over there.
Right.
JP, if you're bird watching in the Eocene, don't you want to see a Gastornis, sir?
Absolutely.
From a safe distance.
Biggest bird in North America. One in our museum.
There's
the
one
museum.
Parked up front, right?
So. Well, no, it's in the lobby now.
Oh, wait, is the Gastornis the terror bird?
Yes.
Right.
And taller than Russell.
Okay, my question is to JP.
Uh-oh.
As I understand it, most museums only display 10% of their collections, and that the majority of awesome fossils and finds are hidden from the public behind closed doors. What are your biggest challenges as a collections manager, and how do you determine what goes on display compared to what stays in the collection vaults?
That's a good question, and it's actually quite limited at this point by the fact that we don't have anyone working on displays who can put the time into it. So it's something that Russell and I and our director would have to kind of tag team, and we're all pretty busy. But if I had my druthers and we had that person, I would tell them to put some of our more, we've been working on some Cretaceous bone bed sites. So basically these are piles of lance formations, sediments where the bones of all kinds of creatures washed up. And we get a lot of just crappy chunkosaurs, which are just rolled pieces of bone that you can't identify, but we get some pretty neat stuff. So we've got two crocodile skulls, and they're actually on display now from the Cretaceous, and they're both pretty cool. Chris Brochu was here a few years ago, and he said he saw one of them. He said, wow, the Lance Formation, there's only three crocodile skulls known from the Lance. And I said, this is number four, and number five is in a jacket in storage. So we have those two, and then we have just a lot of odds and ends. We got a beautiful little pachycephalosaur jaw, about 3 inches long, and we got some toe bones and claws and teeth and just miscellaneous bones of all kinds of things. And it would be really cool to do a display of what died in the Cretaceous.
Right, right.
And how'd they end up on this damn sandbar?
But who decides what gets on display? I mean, obviously there's limited space, but
yeah.
Is that you? I mean, do you say, oh, let's move this skull?
It's a team effort. We got donated by one of our fans, I will say, cast of a Permian Gorgonopsid skull.
Oh.
But that is pretty unique. We don't have anything like that. So that one will probably go pretty high on the list of things to get out there.
Great.
It'll add to our Permian display.
Great.
And right now, in the Cretaceous display right now, we do have a good sampling of all this crap that died. I mean, all these cool animals that died.
Crap that died.